What we know in the face of this pandemic is that our income and wealth disparity is growing larger and is more on public view. We need to make change happen. Too many of our people are struggling at the economic margins of our society and can't care for their families. It's a moral injustice, and it's bad for our nation.
Sister Simone Campbell is the leader of NETWRC, a Catholic social justice advocacy organization in Washington, D.C.
The ultimate irony is being less likely to have good health care, being more likely to have a job where you can't work from home, exposes our communities of color to greater risk and greater impact in this COVID-19 nightmare that we're in the middle of.
Sister Simone is lobbying on Capitol Hill for relief for those suffering, including those in the informal economy, those who will not receive cash payments from the recently passed CARES Act, legislation which she describes as a positive first step, but not enough.
We need to step up and care for the 100%. And by that, I mean everybody's in our care, but those we have to most pay attention to are the ones who are least likely to be seen. They're not the wealthy. They're not the mega donors to politicians. They're not the big corporate entities that are getting their fingers on all this big money. No. It's the people doing the most menial work that keep our society working. It's the person running the metro train. It's the person driving the bus. It's the person sweeping the street. It's the person at the intake place, at the emergency room. It's the person mopping the floor. It's all these people.
Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm your host, Amber Khan. Each week, we explore the beliefs shaping our world. And this week, our show begins taking a closer look at the advocacy for the most unseen in our society. On April 12th, Pope Francis released an Easter letter addressed to popular movements, organizations of all sizes working around the world that the Vatican describes as promoting the common good by addressing a host of issues, from economic inequality and environmental degradation to the rise of xenophobia and populism to addressing health care and hunger. The letter generated excitement among advocates as Pope Francis encouraged global organizations and governments to consider adopting a universal basic wage.
When I read Pope Francis's Easter message to community organizations, well, when he suggested a universal basic wage, I have to say that my heart was lifted. I think of the women that I know that clean houses. They cobble together bit by bit a way to support their families. Or the folks who sell things on the street. Or so many people doing low-wage, part-time jobs, even in healthcare facilities. These are the people who make our nation work, and they're the most underappreciated.
The Pope's call to consider the adoption of a universal basic wage for unprotected workers got Nathan Schneider's attention. A media studies professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Schneider is keenly interested in the intersection of Catholic social teachings and economics. He is also a regular contributor to the Jesuit magazine America. Schneider wrote about the Pope's Easter letter earlier this week. I reached him at his home in Boulder, Colorado to learn more.
Did the Pope really just call for universal basic income? Now, the answer to that isn't completely clear. In the Easter address, he talked about what's translated most directly as universal basic wage, which might be a little different. The message was, we're in a time of crisis, and we may want to start considering this idea. And he puts it in the context not just of relief, but as a way of recognizing for the Pope the kinds of unwaged and underwaged labor that we have in our society. So he presents this in this document to social movements as a redress for the kinds of informal workers who are underpaid, who are contributing tremendous value to our society, with the idea that if everybody were receiving some basic wage or income, it would create space and time for them to participate in the necessary work of care, of serving the poor and serving each other. There's been a growing surge of interest in basic income proposals around the world and certainly across Europe. And the U.S. is one context of that, but it's certainly not the only one.
This Spanish phrase, el salario universal, or universal basic wage or income, is used to describe a policy in Brazil where informal workers in the economy receive a basic minimum. It's not the same as a living wage.
The idea with a living wage is that if you are working, you know, an honest day's work, you should have the kind of income that enables you to have a decent life. And that's a longstanding demand in Catholic social teaching and in many faith communities. For many people, and certainly I can't imagine anything but this from the Pope, the demand would be both, would be people should be paid a living wage, and there should be this additional benefit that ensures that people have a floor. These two demands can be kind of held in opposition, though from the perspective of Catholic social teaching, they would go hand in hand.
The fiscal policy is not a theoretical concept. It's a practice, one that Pope Francis is likely familiar with.
I suspect the Pope's most direct knowledge of it might be from South America. In Brazil, just north of his native Argentina, for some time now had a program called Bolsa Família, which is not a universal basic income, but for the poor has provided a kind of guaranteed wage that has been extremely effective in bringing millions of people out of poverty. And so that might be the experience that he's thinking of.
Economic justice has a long history in Christianity and Catholicism specifically. Schneider points to Pope Leo XIII. He led the church in the last quarter of the 19th century. In the United States, it was the Gilded Age, a time shaped by moguls like Andrew Carnegie, when the working poor earned an average of only $380 a year.
Pope Leo was very concerned about this conflict between labor and capital and this deepening inequality, and sought to create a framework for a new approach. And he really tried to find a third way that would recognize the gifts and strengths of both the kind of capitalist class and the working class, honoring both private property and the right to organize and unionize. And I think that kind of thinking is the sort of thing that we're seeing with Pope Francis here today, is he's not rejecting property, he's not rejecting money, he's not rejecting all these things outright, but he's looking to a proposal that has the capacity to kind of reshape, you know, the whole underlying structure in a way that, you know, that could be transformative.
Schneider points out that many of the Pope's pet issues inspire both enormous enthusiasm and enormous pushback. His framing of both climate change and the plight of refugees as religious and moral issues has not brought the reforms many had hoped for. Is anyone inside the church hierarchy listening?
In a certain sense, you know, you wonder whether he is dooming the idea of basic income to the same fate of other things he's advanced. You know, maybe there's a long game in which later on, you know, his leadership will come to the fore above the counter reactions. But right now, I think he's very aware of that danger and has been proceeding quite cautiously.
Schneider points out that while Pope Francis's economic principles echo Benedict XVI and John Paul II, clerical leaders are not quick to amplify his messages.
In the U.S. church, for instance, it's generally meant that among a lot of the leadership, especially appointed under John Paul or Benedict, Francis has just been ignored. You don't hear him talked about in sermons, in homilies. You don't see bishops echoing things that he's saying in the public square. Often they're sticking to talking points that date to earlier leadership. And as far as I've seen, that has kind of continued here. I haven't seen a kind of counter reaction from the right. I've just seen a kind of silence, I suspect, among those who don't want to hear this and aren't interested. It will be fairly easy to ignore unless it becomes something that he takes up more fervently. You know, I suspect he probably won't make this a major issue of his papacy. I mean, he's really focused on his role as a spiritual leader and on trying to lead a reorientation of values. I think we're seeing an invitation to others to take this on, to recognize that in this kind of policy change, the more important outcome could be a different kind of understanding of the value of labor and the value of our time.
Sister Simone is embracing that invitation.
We as a people need to stand together in a socially distant way, but stand together and speak up for the fact that the most vulnerable are the ones who are being most impacted. And yet again, that's wrong.
It remains unclear how many will join her.
History will judge our society's response with, I think, a real question mark. Why did it take us so long to figure this out that we needed to respond to this pandemic? They're also going to question, how did we care for those who are most vulnerable and on the front line of taking care of our society and not protect them with personal protective equipment, not protect them with testing for this virus, not protect them with a living wage, not protect their families with the capacity to pay their rent and make sure there's food on the table. I think society is going to judge us a little harshly. Yes, we've thrown some money at it. Yes, we're working on legislation to make a difference. Yes, we can change how we will be seen. But right now, it's not looking so good. We need to step up and care for the 100%.
That was Sister Simone Campbell. Since 2004, she has served as the executive director of NETWRC, Advocates for Social Justice, inspired by Catholic Sisters. She is a religious leader, attorney, and the author of A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. And Nathan Schneider, a journalist and media studies professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he directs the Media Design Enterprise Lab. He is the author of God in Proof, The Story of a Search from the Ancients to the Internet, and Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition that is Shaping the Next Economy. If you missed any portion of this conversation, visit us at interfaithradio.org and take a moment to subscribe to our newsletter and to our podcast. Coming up after this short break, author Margaret McMullen reveals how a trip to Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Museum, led to a special assignment that revealed a secret family history. This is Inspired. I'm your host, Amber Kahn. I hope you're enjoying this week's show. I wanted to take a short break to tell you a few things about Inspired that you may not know. Our show was founded by a nun named Maureen Fiedler, who in the days after 9/11 saw a need for a national broadcast that would explore the rich diversity of beliefs among Americans. Since then, our commitment to creating and producing compelling radio has never wavered, nor has our commitment to making it available to everyone for free. No paywalls ever. But it's not free to produce this show, and we don't receive any funds from National Public Radio or the local stations that carry us. So I need to ask you for your support. If you enjoy Inspired, if you value it and count on it, please consider donating today. You can do that on our website at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. And thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.